Welcome to KPTZ's Nature Now, a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of kptz.org.
Hello, this is Deborah Kelso, host of this edition of Nature Now for the first week of January, and we'd like to wish you all a very happy 2017. This week, we are very pleased to have Christy Lassen from Wild Birds Unlimited up in Gardiner back with us on the program. Welcome, Christy. She is here to talk about all of the cool hawks that we have in our area, some to be seen in our very own backyards. But before we get to our main topic, let's first hear the mystery sound of the week. Isn't this a cool sound? It's not often heard, but if you are in the right place, you will hear it a lot. We'll play it again at the end of the program and tell you what it is.
The most notable event of this week is the dramatic drop in the temperature. With most of the week not expected to break out of the freezing zone, Cliff Mass, our well-known atmospheric scientist out of University of Washington, says that this is likely to be the coldest period we've seen since December of 2008. And will be accompanied by a notable drop in humidity and sunny skies.
These cold temperatures will put a bit of a damper on some of the new plant action that we've been noticing, especially the increasing size of green leaf buds on some of our native deciduous shrubs, most notably the red flowering currants, Indian plum, and red elderberries. Our friend Jeff Hammerson also noted that planted or wild-growing filbert shrubs had expanded pollen catkins, though they were not yet releasing pollen, and the terminal buds of black cottonwoods are still closed but noticeably swelling. These buds contain a sticky aromatic rosin that may be made into balm used for medicinal purposes, though it is important not to overharvest them, as with all things. This aromatic rosin from cottonwoods is one of my favorite scents in all the world.
Jeff continued on to tell us some other cool things that he has noticed this last week. Red-breasted sapsuckers made lots of new sap wells in planted holly tree trunks. The wells oozed sap and presumably provided some sweet foods for the birds. He didn't see any insects in the sap, though this is often a major food source for these and other birds.
We were talking earlier about how people think that they're mostly interested in the sap, but they're not mostly interested in the sap. They're mostly interested in the insects that are drawn to the sap.
It's a bug trap
to collect food
for them.
American robins, cedar waxwings, and hermit thrush ate large numbers of fruits in native madrona trees, as well as fruits of planted non-native hawthorns and hollies. They ignored the nearby white fruits of the native snowberry. Small flocks of varied thrush tossed aside fallen leaves of red alder and ate tiny worms they found underneath. They can create large patches of churned-up ground, which several of you have probably been noticing and been wondering about.
With recent rains, moles have been doing a lot of digging too, depositing fresh piles of soil, creating many new molehills on the ground surface. I had also been noticing a lot of new activity all around our area. The cold snap this week will likely be putting a big damper on this industrious activity, much to the relief of those of you with manicured lawns.
Yeah, I know. The moles have just been nuts lately, haven't they?
Big mole year. Lots of moles.
It's always such a pleasure to have Christy Lassen on our show, sharing about various aspects of bird biology. For this show, Christy suggested that we speak about backyard hawks, since one of the advantages of winter is that it's easier to spot some of our more common hawks, as their perching spots are more exposed with all the leaves gone from many of the trees and shrubs. And we are blessed with lots of different species of birds of prey in our area. That includes eagles, owls, vultures, kites, and falcons. But what loosely describes a hawk? We're not talking seahawk here, just to be clear.
The characteristics that make a hawk are primarily that they are diurnal birds of prey, that they are daytime hunters. The other characteristics are that they hunt on the wing and take their prey by surprise. And while I was looking this up, when I looked up what makes a hawk, something interesting that
because
came...
Because it's not really an easy question. I mean, because there's so many general terms
variations
that get tossed
in
about.
There too. Yeah. Well, one of the things that I saw that I thought was kind of interesting is that there are dragonflies that they call hawks because they are daytime hunters, just like our birds of prey.
Yeah, yeah, that makes perfect sense.
Yes. And I do think that the seahawk is probably based on an osprey.
Yes,
I think osprey is our seahawk.
Yeah, I think that's very true. So the hawks in our area are generally broken up into two major categories, right? The accipiters and the buteos.
Yes. Essentially, buteos are more birds of open spaces. They're the birds that are largely, but not exclusively, ones that feed on ground animals. Their bodies are adapted to use thermals to soar on. They have long, broad wings, and they have relatively short tails. Our most common buteo here is the red-tailed hawk. Golden eagles and bald eagles are buteos, too.
You just don't think about that. You think of eagles as completely separate.
They're part of that family. There's so many different categories in there, too. It's an interesting thing to look at. Swainson's hawks and Ferruginous hawks are not native species to us here on the peninsula, but they are birds that both of our rehab centers have as educational birds.
They're common, like back east.
They are. Well, common back east, even in eastern Washington, open plains sort of areas, more for those guys. Both of our rehab centers have these two birds that you can get a really up close
and
great look at
beautiful.
During their programs.
Yeah.
So the accipiters, which is the other main category, are the fast flyers of the raptor world. They have short, rounded wings and relatively long tails, and their bodies are adapted to chase birds through tight spaces like brush and tree branches. Our accipiters here are the sharp-shinned hawks, the Cooper's hawks, and the little less common goshawk.
Those two species cause more confusion in our area than anything else, right?
The Cooper's and the sharp-shinned, definitely.
They're really hard to tell apart.
They are hard to tell apart. The Cooper's hawk and the sharp-shinned are very similar. They have similar characteristics and similar habits. But there's some very distinctive differences in them. The first being the size of the birds.
And part of that is due to the fact that raptors across the board have different size differences. I mean, between sexes.
Between sexes, definitely.
Yeah, the females are generally...
It's about 25%
larger than the males.
So that's
a complicating factor.
That does add in the plot twist of how to tell what's what of what you're looking at. But like two kind of, I guess you'd say, the main thing to look for if you're trying to tell if it's a Cooper's hawk or a sharp-shinned hawk. The sharp-shins are similar in size to a jay or a dove. They average about 10 to 14 inches long. The Cooper's hawk are similar in size to that of a crow. They average about 14 to 20 inches long. And then you get that little overlap. If you're looking at a female sharp-shin, she's just about the same size as a male Cooper's adults are. So there's a couple of other little tricks that you can do to kind of help you tell these two apart. The tail tips of these birds are defining in which one is which. It's one of the most easily noticed differences between these two species. Sharp-shinned hawks' tails are squared off when they're sitting at rest. So it's a very square shape. And their outer feathers are slightly longer, and there's a little small cleft in the middle of it. So it has a little dip right in the middle of the tail, that square tail. And it has a thin white tip. The Cooper's hawk, his tail at rest is rounded in shape, and it has a large white tip on the bottom of it. So those are helpful if they're sitting. If they're flying, it's not quite as easy to tell. Legs are also a defining characteristic in both of these. The sharp-shin, he pretty much gets his name from the way his legs look. He has long, thin, pencil-like legs that have pretty much a sharp-shin on them. And the Cooper's hawk has short, thick legs. So those are some things that can help you sort of tell the difference between the two.
Yeah, those are really good things to look out for. But something else that people don't always realize is the fact that immature birds often look very different from the adults. Even though they're fully fledged, they're as large as the adults, but they look way different.
Definitely. There's different colorations and different patterns on their feathers in the juveniles and the adults. Adult sharp-shins and Cooper's hawks have dark gray backs and rusty barring that is more horizontal on their breasts, and they have very distinct red eyes. The adults, this species, that eye is one of the first things that I look at always to see if it's in a juvenile or an adult.
Well, and people think, oh, that's just so esoteric. I'll never see that. But you do. I mean, it really
noticeable.
Stands out. Yeah.
Definitely. So juvenile sharp-shins and Cooper's hawk both have yellow eyes. They have dark brown vertical stripes on their breasts and brown backs and heads, usually with a little bit of white spotting too. And if you can see the front of the hawk, if it's a juvenile hawk, to try and help you tell the difference between the Coopers and the Sharpshins. The Sharpshins hawk have very thick rufous stripes that extend down the lower belly. And then the Coopers hawk have these thin dark streaks that fade away onto the lower belly to kind of help tell you the difference between the two species too.
Do both Sharpshin and Coopers hawks have the same home range in both summer and winter in our area?
Here on the peninsula, they are year-round residents. They may move a little bit around in the habitat, but they stay here on the peninsula. They don't migrate.
And they mostly prey on birds all year round?
These two species, yes. They are the songbird hunters. And they get a lot of flack for that, too. They kind of get a bad rap at people's bird feeders.
I know. People are just all about the songbirds, and they think, oh, that bad Sharpie or Cooper's.
I can say I have those feelings at times as well, but it's all part of the circle of life. The hawks in your backyard at your bird feeder are the checks and balance of your habitat. To have one at your feeder means that your habitat is in balance. That hawk is going to keep your bird population healthy and happy.
And they're not the only birds that take advantage of bird feeders. I mean, my neighbor, Jamie Rudink, was telling me about watching a great blue heron pluck a bird off the bird feeder. I was just so shocked. I had no idea that they did that.
They're meat eaters. The herons are. They're kind of...
They're opportunists.
Eaters. I actually saw one eat a vole the other day. So
wow.
They will eat lots of things. Yes.
They're quite remarkable. But back to hawks, the northern goshawk is another hawk that's closely related to Sharpshinned and Coopers, right?
In the same family of accipiters, immature goshawks and Cooper's hawks are very similar. However, the goshawks are much more uncommon for us. The immature goshawk is heavily streaked like a Cooper's, but he's much bigger in size. Goshawks are comparable in size to red-tailed hawks. The habitat that they prefer is old-growth forest, and that's one of the reasons why I think that they're more uncommon, because we have less and less old-growth forest out here in our area. Northern goshawks are secretive birds, and they typically live in large tracts of forest, so they are hard to find out there. They don't typically occur in populated areas, so any hawk that you see in your backyard is more likely to be a Cooper's than a goshawk. The Cornell Lab of Ornithology says that your best chance of finding a northern goshawk is to spend time in mature forests, being as quiet, observant, and patient as possible. And I think one of the reasons these birds really like these old-growth forest areas is because they build and maintain up to 8 alternate nests within their nesting areas.
Wow, I had no idea.
Yeah. So they're industrious. They like to build lots of nests in case one of them fails or falls out of the tree or something happens to it, and they can move to another nesting site.
Yeah, that's good planning. I spend a lot of time working in old forests, and I used to see and hear goshawks a lot more often than I do now. And it's worrying to me. I would like to see a study done specifically on them and whether their population is declining on the Olympic Peninsula.
There are studies being done on goshawk populations. The North American Breeding Bird Survey indicates that populations on our entire continent have declined about 21% between 1966 and 2014. There's another organization studying them too called Partners in Flight, which estimates that the global breeding population of the goshawks is at 400,000 birds, which seems like a lot, but for our whole continent, that's not a very large number. Today, the biggest threat to breeding goshawks is really timber harvest. The goshawks depend on mature trees and forests with relatively intact canopies for nesting and for foraging. Nesting birds are sensitive to logging activities such as building roads and loading and skidding felled trees. And the U.S. Forest Service has included the goshawks now on its sensitive species list for many regions. This requires that proposed management activities such as logging consider potential impacts on goshawks. So hopefully we can see a resurgence in their numbers. That would be really good.
I would hope for that as well. So the other common medium-sized hawk that we have neglected to mention thus far is the northern harrier, which used to be called the marsh hawk, and I still think it should be called. What caused the name change there?
I love northern harriers. I think they're a gorgeous bird, and while I was reading up on them, I found something interesting just kind of to the side is that they
we
should
always
be
like
there.
Those aside.
I read that the northern harriers should be in their own classification of birds of prey called circus, which is, as the name suggests, that they tend to circle low over open marsh country to catch their prey. And I did do a little digging, too, on why they changed the name from Marsh Hawk to Northern Harrier. And I found a really interesting, very funnily written article from a man named Mike O'Connor. He owns a Birdwatchers General Store on Cape Cod, and he helped explain the change. And here's the gist of it. In 1982, the American Ornithological Union decided that we should start calling marsh hawks Northern Harriers. The AOU, which is the American Ornithological Union, which is a union that helps promote birds, not give them more coffee breaks, works hard to ensure common bird names are fitting and consistent. They wanted everyone in the country to refer to a particular bird using the same name. And sometimes these names...
And that would be a struggle.
Yes, definitely. Sometimes these names changes are based on new scientific evidence, and other times they're due to public pressure. There's an example that's kind of fun to just show you. In 2003, for example, the rock dove, which was kind of commonly known as our city park pigeon, was officially changed to rock pigeon. The AOU finally realized that no matter how hard they tried to convince people, no one was ever going to call a pigeon a dove. And sometimes a new name is actually an improvement. The peregrine falcon was called by the name of Duck Hawk, which kind of sounds like a villain in a comic book.
They were considered villains to duck hunters, probably.
Possibly, yes. They were big-time duck eaters. In 1973, they changed the name of Pigeon Hawk, and instead it was awarded one of the best names in the world, which is the Merlin.
Uh-huh.
Yes. So that's an upgrade, too. But, like, the marsh hawk, the original name is different for that bird because it fits. This bird is a marsh dweller. It eats, it sleeps, it breeds in marshes. If you see a bird that's slowly and methodically flying up just above a marsh or a grassland, you can pretty much bet it's a marsh hawk. So why did they change the name? Sometimes officials do things that defy logic. But this move isn't as crazy as it seems. There are about a dozen different species of harriers found throughout the world, and the marsh hawk just happens to be one of them. So they changed the name, and because they didn't want this one harrier to have a non-harrier name, basically.
Uh-huh. So it's more a way of grouping it with the rest of its family members than helping us distinguish what it is.
So in 1982, that's when they changed marsh hawk to Northern Harrier.
Uh-huh.
The Northern Harrier is distinctive from a long distance away. He is a slim, long-tailed hawk gliding low over marshes or grassland, holding its wings in a V-shape. Harriers have a white patch at the base of its tail and a distinctive black bar along the inside edge of their wings. Up close, it has a very owlish, dish-shaped face that helps it hear mice and voles scurrying around under the vegetation.
Because it has a different technique than a lot of hawks do of hunting, right? It's hunting more with its ears
with
than
sound.
It is with its eyes. And it looks a little bit like a short-eared owl than when it's hunting. We have run out of time for today. We've nattered on so long about cool birds. The good news is that we're going to have part two of our talk with Christy airing next month. So thanks so much for being with us, Christy.
Thanks for having me.
We have some great upcoming natural history events to tell you about for the new year. There's a very interesting lecture coming up this Sunday, January 8th at 3 p.m. at the chapel at Fort Warden. It's sponsored by the Port Townsend Marine Science Center and features Dr. George Dvorky sharing his work on 40 years of research on the seabirds of Cooper's Island in Alaska and how they're responding to a melting Arctic. Go to ptmsc.org for more details.
Then on Tuesday, January 10th, head over to the Dungeness River Audubon Center for movie night. This month's film is Return of the River, about our very own Elwha River set free. The movie starts at 6 p.m. and includes a discussion and Q&A with director John Gusman after the viewing. Admission is free. Go to olympicpeninsulaaudubon.org for more information.
And lastly, join the Jefferson Land Trust Natural History Society for an urban bestiary neighborhood nature walk from 10 a.m. to noon on Thursday, January 12th. Looking at the treasure trove of wildlife dwelling in your very own backyard of Port Townsend. Go to jltnatural@saveland.org to RSVP and get details. And here's our mystery sound again. that is the call of a Merlin. But you don't hear it very often. I mean, they're just so darn stealthy that you only hear it when there's a pair and they're breeding and they're nattering back and forth. And I long to hear them.
It's their love song.
Yeah. So, Christy, why don't you tell us a little bit about Merlins?
Merlins are really cool little birds. They are small, fierce falcons. They use surprise attack to catch their prey, which is mostly songbirds or shorebirds. They're very powerful flyers, and you can tell them from the larger falcons by their rapid wing beats and overall dark tones. Merlin populations have largely recovered from 20th century declines, thanks to the ban on the pesticide DDT and their availability to adapt to life around towns and cities. While I was researching merlins, I found some really cool, interesting facts about them. Merlins have been seen hunting cooperatively in pairs. They hunt large flocks of birds like cedar waxwings or robins that flock together tightly in bushes. And one merlin will swing from underneath up through the bush and startle all of the birds out of the bush. And then the partner will come and hit a bird as they burst out of the bushes.
Wow, that's cool.
So they hunt cooperatively, which is pretty neat. Merlins tend not to build their own nests. Instead, they take over the old nests of other raptors or crows. And they were our ones that were called the pigeon hawks. But merlin's definitely a better name for them. They were called pigeon hawks because in flight, they look somewhat pigeon-like.
Because they have those tucked wings.
Yes, their wings kind of tuck back in when they're flying. Yep.
Well, and I have been hearing that the populations have been coming back a bit in our area. They don't normally breed here, but we'll get them as winter visitors sometimes, or we'll see them in migration. But the incidence of seeing them has been increasing somewhat. A friend of mine, Fred Sharp, saw some at Port Ludlow, saw a pair this year. And he was saying that one of the best places on the peninsula to see them is down at Lake Quinault.
Very nice. It's a gorgeous place to go and see birds.
Yes, indeed it is. And that's it for KPTC's Nature Now for the first week of January. Thanks very much for joining me, Christy. And thanks to all of you for listening. Remember, if you missed any of our program or want to listen again, this program will be rebroadcast at 5 p.m. on Thursday, 11:30 on Saturday, and available as a podcast in a week or so at kptz.org. We wish you a very happy and healthy new year, and happy trails all year long.
Nature Now is produced by Nan Evans and edited by Charlie Fleischman.
Closing music is I See Hawks in L.A., performed by the group I See Hawks in L.A.
Hawks in L.A. I see hawks in L.A. If you see hawks, then maybe we should talk. I see hawks in L.A. I hear trains in the night. I hear trains in the night. Lonesome sound, lonesome as this town. One more day on the city.